The Dawn of Radio at Brown, 1936 to 1945.
There's a great sensational wonder today, we know. Everyone is talking and fooling with radio. It's a wireless telephone. I just bought one of my own. Now I sit at home alone and hear them dish the dirt.
In 1936, Brown became the first college in the country with a radio station, according to the Encyclopedia Brunonia, the authoritative book on Brown University's history. For decades, Brown students have been proud of this legacy, always eager to tell the next generation of students that fact. The only problem is, simply not true. Probably more than a dozen colleges were operating radio stations before 1936. But perhaps what does make Brown's early radio operation unique is the way it began, purely as a bootleg student initiative with no interference from the university. It is generally agreed, however, that WBRU, the Brown Network, is the oldest continuously operating college station in the country.
Once they start, station LOVE signing off. Good night.
To set the scene, we start our story with a quick reminder of how important radio was in 1936. Here's Brown Professor of American Civilization, Susan Smulyan.
In 1936, what you have is a booming commercial radio system. CBS, NBC, every community in the country had radio stations. You're in the middle of the Depression, but still many people all said that the last thing they wanted to give up was their radio.
In the fall of 1936, a fellow by the name of George Abraham enrolled as a freshman at Brown University. He had spent that summer tinkering with radio components, and a few months after arriving at Brown, he came back to campus from Thanksgiving break with a load of radio equipment big enough to fill up his small dorm room in Littlefield Hall. Wanting to share his large collection of classical music with his peers, he connected his friends' radios to his phonograph. On November 30th, 1936, he switched on the system that became known as the Brown Network.
Word got around about the clever freshman, although the first mention of the network in the school's newspaper, the Brown Daily Herald, bore the anticlimactic headline, "Radio Network in Brunonia has limited number of subscribers." Later, when George Abraham was hooking up another dorm to his network, he met David Borst. Abraham was a natural at doing business, personable, and a great negotiator. But David Borst was an engineering student with experience in amateur radio. Joseph Parnicki was also in the class of 1940.
George fortunately had some money. Most of us didn't. And he actually underwrote the project largely until the day when we started getting enough contributions.
Louis Bloch, another student from that era, said that Brown's new president, Henry Wriston, was on a tour of the campus when he asked why so many students were on the rooftops. He was told, "Oh, that's the Brown Network," and subsequently dropped the subject without another word, indicating the inklings of a university administration attitude that usually prevailed throughout the next 70 years.
By the end of 1936, all the main dorms were hooked up to the network, but they only broadcast sporadically. Normally, they would play music or bring in a guest to speak. In an article published in the Brown Daily Herald on February 2, 1937, a Brown student said one day he hoped the system would broadcast lectures so he could stay in bed longer.
By 1937, George had turned his room at Slater Hall into a complete broadcasting studio. But he had accumulated so much equipment that he couldn't stay in his own room. So he set up in the icy basement of the dorm. That year, the Brown Network began broadcasting 2 hours of planned programs several days a week.
And this was before television, you must remember. So students in the evening, if they wanted to entertain themselves, had to use the radio.
Richard Walton, class of 51.
I think we had quite a few listeners on campus.
For a $1 fee, Brown students could be connected to the network. A system of directory managers stationed in each dorm were in charge of collecting money and making sure that the wires were working properly.
The Brown Network continued to grow, and in its third year, established itself in the Student Activities Building at Fonts House on Waterman Street.
We had a jack of all trades, one microphone, one room.
Joseph Parnicki, class of 1940.
They just assigned us a room that happened to be free.
Sherwin Drury was in the class of 1941.
I was rooming in South Hope. Yeah, I spent 4 years there, and I could see the studio in Fonts House from my room in South Hope. Actually, we could see at night if there was a light on up there. We knew there was somebody working.
The new setup allowed for more creative and extensive programming, with 4 hours of broadcasting every weekday.
And I think it was pretty well listened to around the campus. I never figured out, you know, any numbers, but certainly if you went down a hallway in the dormitory, you were going to hear it.
Harvey Sindel, from the class of 1951, explained how music DJs worked at the time.
Classical was not too well emphasized and handled by a couple of the students who knew classical music, were into it, followed it, whatever. And then there was a hodgepodge, some pop of the time, some jazz of the time, mixed bag because we were always lacking records and tried not to play the same one too much, which is totally contrary to the way Top 40 radio is these days. I laugh at that every time I read about it. But then the problem was we didn't have enough to play.
That wasn't the only challenge, according to Richard Walton, also class of 51.
In those days, we used to use 78 RPM recordings. The recording never lasted more than 3 minutes and a few seconds. So if you played classical music, as we did, you would have four two-sided 78s, and you'd play part one, and then on the other turntable, you'd try to make sure there was no gap between the first one and the second one, and then you'd play side three, and you hoped that you didn't have to pick it up and turn it over. You hope they had done it in such a way that you could go from turntable to turntable. So classical music then was a bit choppy. And all of the jazz recordings, they all had to be 3 minutes and some odd seconds. So the kind of music that's so easily played today just couldn't be done then. If Duke Ellington were making a recording, it could be a wonderful piece of music, but it had to be over in 3 minutes and some odd seconds.
In 1939, David Sarnoff, the founder of NBC, visited the station, and a flurry of press coverage from the Providence Journal followed. By then, a team of over 40 students had strung 30,000 feet of wire through steam tunnels and over the roofs of buildings into dormitories and frat houses. It became impossible to ignore the Brown men climbing and crawling all over campus, and university officials started to get nervous, threatening to close down operations. But George Abraham and David Borst used the media attention to their advantage, keeping the administration from restricting their operation. Students became more ambitious with their program ideas, and basketball and baseball games, as well as other social events downtown, were remotely broadcast by the Brown Network.
We used to broadcast from the Providence Biltmore Hotel ballroom, whether it was a prom or whether it was a fraternity dance, and the network would go down, and the engineers knew how to handle things so that it didn't cost us anything to broadcast. We'd commandeer a public phone down there and unhitch it for sit them on the telephone at the studio, and we'd broadcast 3 hours of dance music from the ballroom so they could hear it on the network. Our roommate and I wanted to go down to Princeton in New Jersey to broadcast a Brown football game that was going to take place there, and of course no students of any number had a car, so we hitchhiked down. And we started Friday afternoon, and we got as far as New York City and we slept at the YMCA in New York City for a dollar or so. And then we hitchhiked, got across the river and down to Princeton, and we broadcast the game. But that was quite an experience, and we won the game, by the way.
As its audience and programming grew, the Brown Network abandoned the informal collection of donations and became reliant on advertising revenue. News of the Brown Network spread to other Eastern college campuses, where students were interested in starting a communication system of their own. On February 18, 1940, the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System was born. In the middle of a terrible blizzard, students from 12 colleges assembled at Sales Hall at Brown University for the first meeting of the IBS. It was established as a nonprofit mutual benefit organization with George Abraham as chairman.
At the time, we were very proud of the fact that IBS, as we call it, you know, there was CBS and NBC and all that. We used to toss around IBS as if it were a big deal, and maybe to some extent it was.
Pembroke, the women's college adjoining the Brown campus to the north, also became interested in the network. Jean Cummings was in the Pembroke class of 1940, and by 1939, she oversaw a team of over 30 Pembroke women who worked at the station.
It was the fall of 39, my senior year. Some of the fellows at Brown, whom I knew, came over and asked me if I would try to get permission for them to wire up Metcalf Hall, which was one of the women's dorms. And so I went to, who was it, our activities director or something, and I think I sort of bribed her by asking her if I could interview her on the radio, and I sold it to her. I remember they worked all one Saturday morning, and they were bringing wires through pipes and everything else, and we're up on the roof of Metcalf Hall. And they got us wired up in time so we could listen to one of the football games.
When World War II broke out, more Pembroke women joined the station, partly from necessity since there were so few men on campus. During that era, the station was increasingly referred to by the call letters WBRU, even though it was a closed-circuit station and still called the Brown Network by many. A lot of extracurricular activities shut down during the war.
These were very strange years, and somehow WBRU stayed on the air during the war, and this was a very curious campus then because there were not all that many men around. And in the years right after 1945, there were veterans returning by the ton. I was a 17-year-old kid. The veterans were just returning, and what they wanted to do was party. It was serious party time then. And I think I had 3 C's, 5 D's, and an E my first year at Brown because I was just a kid, and I got swept up in the excitement of all these guys coming back from the war.
With the end of the war in 1945, everything seemed brighter. National business came in, new facilities and equipment were discussed, and the program lineup took on new shows, longer time slots, and increased variety. By the end of 1946, WBRU was broadcasting 10 hours a day.